Hello, and welcome to Films That Time Forgot, a podcast where we take on films from the past that have been overlooked by audiences and critics. I'm Adam Thornton, and joining me is previous guest and longtime mate, Joel Gutteridge.
Hey Adam, hey, thank you for having me, mate. But not thank you for making me watch this film.
Oh yeah, we're gonna come on to that. What first of all, man, just introduce yourself and tell us what's been going on.
So my name's Joel. I work for a tech company that's within the media industry. We service, different clients across the industry, and I have a background in filmmaking, being a camera assistant and being a DP myself back in the day. So yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Okay, and now on to the thing you've been dreading the most, today's episode subject. We are looking at the bizarre, to say the least, 1991 Bruce Willis action comedy Hudson Hawk. Now, first of all, Joel, I want to ask, did you hear about this film before I messaged you about it?
I am fairly sure I've seen this as a child, and it came back to me like a fever dream in moments where I was like, I have definitely seen this shot before, couldn't tell you when. I've obviously blacked it out of my memory, and in the next 10 years, I'm sure I'll have completely erased this from my brain.
I mean, because the film itself is kind of like a fever dream, but because tonally it is all over the place. There's slapstick comedy, there's normal action, there's that you would expect from a Bruce Willis film. There's all sorts of surreal imagery, which you wouldn't expect from the man himself. But this was actually based on a story treatment he wrote, Bruce Willis wrote, when he was working as a bartender before. He made it sort of big with Moonlighting and very big with Die Hard. He wrote the story with his buddy Robert Kraft, and it was greenlit off the back of the success of both Die Hard films, Die Hard 1 and 2, and the Look Who's Talking films. The production budget massively overran. The budget ballooned to a massive 60 million, which for 1991 money is pretty expensive, to put it mildly. There were lots of rewrites, and the female lead, played by Andie MacDowell in a thankless role, was recast twice. First, it was going to be Mariska Detmers, a Dutch actress who then dropped out at the last minute. I believe at one point Isabella Rossellini, who later worked on the Bruce Willis film Death Becomes Her, was considered. And briefly, Madonna was being floated when she was on a massive world tour. She dropped by the set, and apparently Joel Silver, the producer, tried to get her to stay on and work in the film. That didn't work. So finally they settled on McDowell. And the film was a massive bomb. It made 17 million in the US. Because the studio didn't know how to market it. They first tried marketing it as an action movie in the vein of Die Hard, but then when that strategy flopped, they then moved to market it as a comedy. And that reflects the kind of confused nature of the film as a whole that we're going to come on to. But what's interesting is that it did a lot better overseas. It made 80 million internationally, and the critics, including one British critic Mark Kermode, who Joel will know about, really cites this as an underrated movie. But I mean, there's no other polite way to say it. It is a clusterfuck.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I couldn't find much redeeming quality in it. But like you said, like the budget doesn't surprise me. I can see a lot of money that goes into this, and this does scream as a project that would get greenlit based on somebody's success,
Oh,
right? Like
yeah.
it's like, yeah, absolutely, we'll build on a reputation for Bruce Willis that he's been building in the last few films. And just a sort of a blank check, and sometimes those blank checks just are not worth cashing the bill.
Because there's a real uniqueness about it that I find kind of charming on one level, but another level, it's like, yeah, the only way this is getting greenlit is if this guy is like a major A-lister, because Otherwise, a studio executive would just go, nah, and chuck it in the bin.
Yeah, I think like there's some sweet things in here, right? It's really like in a way kind of harmless and sweet, and but it never stops moving to
Oh
give you
no.
a second with the characters to really care about them at all. Like, the relationship between you'll have to help me here, Adam, the Bruce Willis and the
Danny Aiello.
yeah, Daniela. Is the only thing that's sort of built up a little bit, and even that
Yeah.
feels rushed.
Yeah, I mean, on one level, it's kind of a relief compared with some of the bloated comic book stuff we get now, where it's like over 2 hours long. This is like an hour 35, an hour 40, so you're quick in, quick out. But yeah, the pace of the film is kind of relentless, which is funny because there's no indication of this from how it begins, because we begin with this kind of, it's almost like the Princess Bride, like with a storybook opening up. And this hard-boiled narrator telling us about how in the 1491, Leonardo da Vinci made this gold machine that can turn lead into gold. And this is where the production design really shows off, because they filmed this on location, partly in a castle, partly in a Hungarian studio that one of the producers owned. And the gold machine, we see the gold machine being built, and it looks fantastic. Looks like something out of a high-grade fantasy film. We see sparks flying up. When we see kind of Da Vinci putting these crystal pieces in order to make it work. We see sunlight streaming in, it turning into rainbow laser beams, the gold being produced. And then later on, we kind of see Da Vinci's testing out his flying machine. And that looks awesome. They've clearly built a real life flying machine. And the stud work when we see his assistant soaring across the air is great. But then in the middle, we get him painting the Mona Lisa. And we find out the reason why she's got her mouth closed is because when he goes to paint her, she's got her mouth open and she's got wearing this god-awful joke shop teeth. And it comes right in the middle of these grand epic set pieces. And this sets up the tone of the movie where 1 minute it will go from epic action or epic large scale set pieces to really goofy, slapsticky visual humor that doesn't work at all.
The goofy visual like humor, it's I try to think about it in the sense of like, was this for children, right? Like,
Oh, it is
would a
not.
child, that's the thing I kept coming back to. I was like, as a kid, would I be laughing hysterically seeing the Mona Lisa with the thing?
Yeah.
And maybe, right? Maybe, but I don't think if this is a child's film either
Oh,
at
God,
all.
no. I mean, when we get onto the stuff with the villains and some of the violence, I mean, this film in the UK gets a 15 rating. In America, it's an R rating. And you can see why. It's the tonal shifts are clanging and uncomfortable, and you can see why the studio had a hard time pitching this film to audiences, because who is this aimed at?
Absolutely.
And we go now from this sort of sublime to the kind of ridiculous, as 500 years later we cut to Eddie Hudson Hawk Hawkins, played by the man himself, Bruce Willis, getting released from Sing Sing prison for cat burglary. And now I have to say, the one consistent thing about this film I do like, and the one guy who seems to have confidence in everything going on, is Bruce Willis himself. He is on top form in this film.
Yeah, he is committing. Like, as the film went on, I was like, wow, this must have been hard to keep acting momentum in. Like you say, it's a lot of slapstick comedy, it's a lot of goofiness, and then it's like a lot of like, exposition as well, like little dumps just so you can get from one place to another. And I was like, that must have been exhausting. But you're right, he kind of gives it all he's got the whole way through.
And what comes across from the Richard E. Grant book is he was very much the momentum behind it. Like, he was constantly encouraging Richard E. Grant to go bigger and bigger, which, as we're going to come into later, you can see with this performance, he is literally looks like his head's about to explode in some scenes. He is mugging so much. And Bruce Willis was pushing for him to do that. He was pushing, and he was pushing everybody to work at his level. And it was to the detriment, I guess, to the production. But it's good to see him like this compared to how he ended his career.
I just think like a lot of the actors are obviously taking direct. I think it's poor direction more than it is poor acting. There's a punch, like we were talking, there's so many good actors in this, and there's so many good character actors in this. It comes from direction rather than poor performances. My take on it.
I mean, the director of this was Michael Lehman, who had only made the Christian Bale Winona Ryder dark comedy Heathers 2 years beforehand, which had been a sleeper hit, but that was a low budget film. And Hudson Hawk is a big budget, and he apparently got overwhelmed by both Bruce Willis and by Joel Silver, who also produced our previous episode, Swordfish. So he was completely lost.
Yeah, Joel Silver has that habit. Now he has a reputation of
Oh,
taking over, and Bruce Willis is got a big, presence by this point, so I can imagine this guy getting walked all over in this production. Maybe that's not true, but yeah, I can imagine that happening.
So we also go from Hudson Hawk getting out of prison, and he's met by his parole officer, tries to get him to do a sort of to get by to do a sort of heist on an auction house. He rejects this and is met by his good old buddy, Tommy Fivetone, played by Danny Aiello. Now, Danny is another person who I think commits to his role and does a pretty good job, I feel,
I
again.
think he's actually grounded in a way that like I thought he was cheeky and they had good, banter between the two characters. And I thought, maybe when the film was moving already at a fast pace, now, you go 500-year jump, but there being no connection other than the fact that that this item is going to be up, he's gonna have to steal this item probably. I was like, maybe this relationship between these two guys is the thing, Danny Ocean and Brad Pitt's character from Ocean 11, two thieves who have this like quick banter and past that is, kind of enjoyable to be like to be a viewer of.
Yeah, and I like his sort of chemistry with sort of Eddie with Hudson Hawk. They kind of, they kind of bantered together. The only thing that wouldn't, I was thinking, the one thing that wouldn't work today would be the fat jokes, which is probably, which is like the least objectionable thing, because later on there's heavier stuff. But I can remember watching this thinking, there would be so many think pieces now about the way Danny gets treated in this film.
I think it's like I think to give the film credit, it's two characters who have like a rapport and
It's
are
banter. It's
teased
banter.
and teasing each other, and it's done. It's done quite in a way of like care and love between two people instead of it being like malice or being like an attack or something. But yeah, again, it is the product of a 90s film where you undoubtedly are gonna look back at it and go, oh, that's kind of in poor taste, or do you know what I mean?
Well, although I have to say it's not, it's carried off pretty well. And we also get some really clunky product placement for Nintendo,
That's true.
which crops up at the end, and it was meant to promote the Hudson Hawk video game, which came out on the Game Boy and which I have played. Spoiler alert,
Is that are you gonna be?
it's not very good, is what I'm gonna say.
I'm
It's
not
it,
surprised.
it, it controls it, it is much like the film. It kind of can It's just all over the it's all over the map. And there's also a running joke about how Hudson Hawk really wants a cappuccino. And when they go to this old bar that's been hipsterized, he goes to drink his cappuccino, but it gets shot out of his hands by the Mario brothers, one of whom is played by Frank Stallone, Sly's brother.
Really? Oh, that's amazing. I didn't know that.
Because there's a brief dig at Sly, which Bruce Willis says. He says, instructions so simple, even your brother can understand, and it's clearly meant to be a wink to the audience.
Oh,
Get it,
okay.
because it's Frank Stallone. You know
That
Frank, you know the famous Frank Stallone, Sly Stallone's brother.
also going back to the cappuccino bit, that
Yeah.
the through line of the whole thing. There's something about this bit, this joke, I just hated. I can't
Really?
explain it. It doesn't, it's like so unoffensive, right? I think it's so weird that the thing he wants to do when he comes out of prison is have a cappuccino. It just, for some reason, the whole bit just enraged me every time it came on. I had no
Really? It
reason for it
enraged
to.
you. It enraged you, you say.
I can't explain it, Adam. Like, I literally was like, why is there so much cappuccino talk?
Well,
But there's no reason for it to, but it did.
I mean, it's the early 90s. Maybe people had just discovered cappuccinos.
Yeah, I think that's probably it.
So what happens is that the Mario brothers, again, like with the parole officer, want Hudson to rob the auction house, and they want him to steal this Da Vinci statue of a horse. Hudson Hawk, he's got a good line here. He says, I tell you to kiss my ass, but I'm gonna settle with telling you to slurp my butt. And the Mario brothers then threaten to put Hudson Hawk back behind bars, because there's a reveal that reveals that the parole officer is working with them. So Hudson and Tommy Five Tone are in the heist, and they prepare for it by timing the heist to songs, because they say such and such a song, and Hudson Hawk knows, oh, that's 2 minutes 42 seconds, which kind of fits the campy tone of the film, but it's incredibly impractical.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I quite liked it. It was quite like, again, these are the moments where we get these two actors getting to have a lot of time on set together, a lot of screen time together. And actually, they're just very like quick with each other, and they're very quick off the mark. And I quite enjoyed that. But yeah, there's a lot of that as well, in the sense that there's a lot of constantly running jokes, that are
Oh,
like,
yeah.
that are set up right at the beginning, cappuccino being an example, and running all the way through. This thing, he hears a song and he knows the time, and that is a running joke all the way through. It never lets up, or it never, I guess, has a payoff in
It
an
kind of
interesting way.
does. They both kind of do. I mean, I'm going to disagree with you a bit with these two running gags. I feel like they do pay off, but I think it's whether they work as running jokes constantly throughout the film. And
Right.
also when they're doing the heist, on the one hand, because they're basically singing to the songs Swinging on a Star, during the auction house, it's literally them waltzing in, swapping the security tape with an old tapes to fool the security guards, and them just singing along loudly at the tops of their voices. They're lucky nobody else is in the auction house at the time, whilst they're robbing the safe of the horses. And on the one hand, both Willis and Aiello have good singing voices and they gel well
Yeah.
together, but as a heist scene, it doesn't work at all. You're like, how
No.
would nobody hear this?
Yeah. It really lends to the absurdist, like, I don't know, nature of the tone they're trying to aim for, where they can. The problem I have is, like, there's no. It feels like an absence of stakes, right? Like,
Yeah.
and that's okay to a certain extent, but, like, he is out of prison and doesn't want to go back. And that seems to be a driving force for him. And then he's like singing out loud in middle of a heist, not 2, 3, 4 minutes later. It just doesn't work in the sense of like a cohesive story that you can like follow, in a linear way.
And also as well, it's very inconsistent because later on we do get more of an action-packed heist. Although I will say the action in this film is not great. It's very patchy. Sometimes it's really good, other times it's like a bit kind of slapsticky, and then other times it's very like low level. Like with this heist, there's not much action at all. It's literally once they get the statue and the security guards realize that they've been tricked, there's just a brief chase scene which ends with Bruce banging the security guards' heads together slapstick wise, then running off the roof, and then literally falling off the roof, and then it cuts to them falling into a chair into the parole officer's apartment with the horse. There's no action, there's no real action there at all.
I this was another thing that I found the transition really jarring and
Yeah.
not satisfying. If in a storyboard, it might look really nice to have them fall off the roof and then land into a chair in the room or something. It might look very
Yeah.
comic booky, but this looks kind of sloppy, and it also takes away from any tension that you were experiencing. And it's actually quite a tense situation he's going into next. So
Yeah.
it's very like,
This scene is very, oh, this scene is totally very different. It's a dimly lit parole officer's apartment where it's the parole officer, the Marrier brothers, and a mysterious British butler called Alfred who enters, who again is totally off with the rest of the scene. And it's basically
absolutely.
because they give it to Alfred to inspect. He smashes the horse, finds out it's a fake, but he gets the finds out it's a fake, but he gets a part of the gold machine, the crystal that we know is the gold, part of the gold machine, but the characters don't. And he then slashes the parole officer's neck with this knife he's got concealed in his sleeve. So it's like a really, and you see blood gush out of the neck. And then the guy goes, well, I guess he got his cut. And
God.
the tonal shift is so awkward.
It is. Like we were saying at the beginning, it's like with the goofy humor, with the violence, again, there's ways to do that that are, I guess, engaging and, kind of unsettling. This just feels lazy and a bit, just cheap,
It
the bits are a bit
feels
cheap.
like the script was being rewritten at that point, which it did multiple times. But you do wonder if they're trying to work out what sort of tone shall we get here? Are we going for more of a campy, pig pampery heist film? Are we going for like sort of where the action's very slapsticky? Are we going for a darker, violent Slade and Bruce Willis thing? And this whole scene where the parole officer's being killed, again, this feels like something from a Bruce Willis film. It feels more like something from Last Boy Scout,
Exactly.
with kind of very black humor. And so, but so as Hudson Hawk discovers that the statue that was stolen was a fake, and he goes to back to the auction house where the real life Da Vinci statue is being auctioned off by. Now you'll know this character, Joel. You may know him. The auctioneer for British listeners is played by the late great John Savidant, who died recently, who plays the character Fred Elliot in British soap opera Coronation Street.
Oh really? That's wild. I didn't clock that at all.
Yeah, no, I just noticed it when I watched the film, literally, because it was like the day after he was announced he died, and I thought, oh, that's Fred Elliot of Corrie. So for any British viewers of the film, you'll get a bit of a hey, it's that guy when you see him.
Right,
And
okay. Go ahead.
Hudson then meets art expert Anna Bragley, played by Andie MacDowell, who she's normally criticized for acting, but I think she does a good job with what she's given.
Yeah, agreed. I think again, the smaller moments between the actors where their dialogue is fast and their there's a vibe is where it's the strongest, and it does end with more of that. And I think she, with what she's given, is doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, considering she was cast right at the last minute when filming was still going on, she has good chemistry with Bruce Willis. I mean, the two of them really bounce off well with each other, and it's frustrating because like stuff like the love relationship between Hudson and Anna, that really works, and you're like, oh, it's such a shame the rest of the film doesn't come together because this actually, there's something here.
And I mean, I don't know what minute mark we're kind of at, but this is super early in the film, right? So
Yeah,
much has happened to
we're
this
like,
point.
We're like 20, 30 minutes into the film, I feel.
So much has happened, and so much is going to happen where her character is revealed to be in leagues with so many different
Oh,
people and
yeah.
with
It
so
is
many
mad
different
what
motives
happens.
that it's just wild that, like, they're, the moment, the tiny small moments they get kind of do work. Because
Yeah.
the plot is so wild. Like, as it
Oh.
right now, it's pretty simple. Not simple,
Yeah.
but comparatively.
It goes right off the rails from this point onwards. And this is where you can see the rewrites really kicking in because so Anna identifies the statue as real. The bidding starts, but it's interrupted by our two villains, Darwin and Minerva Mayflower, played by Richard E. Grant and Sandra Bernhard. Now, Richard E. Grant wrote a book which includes sections on the making of Hudson Hawk. The book is called With Nails. I would highly recommend it. And yeah, I'm going to be quoting from this book later on. But yeah, he's great. He is hamming it up to the max as the insanely rich Darwin Mayflower. And whilst he's great in it, Sandra Bernhard is nails on a chalkboard annoying.
I sort of disagree a little bit. I think they're both giving a lot. I think, for me, I think it's probably a bit equal in terms of how much I enjoyed their performance. Like, I think they're both over, but that's probably that's from a directing point of view.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think I found her, grating in the same way you did.
I
But
don't know. I think it's her voice because I've seen one or two other
yeah.
things with Sandra Bernhard in, including the Scorsese film she's in, King of Comedy. And I don't really like her in these films either. So I think it's more, I don't know what it is. It's just her voice is so, it's, you've got to listen to her talk. It's because she's like really pumping it up, like a lot of the cast are to 11. And her voice at 11 is just, oh, I do not like it. I'm sorry.
I think they're both like they're I like they're ultimately, like all the characters, they're a little bit void of like emotive and depth. But
Yeah, I mean
they're
they
there,
are,
yeah.
yeah, I mean they are given something later on, but it's very small. It's just like, I want power. And clearly this is something
Yeah.
added in at the last minute because they realize, oh, why do these guys want what they want?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So yeah, so as they outbid everybody else for the statue, Fred Elliott bangs down his gavel and explodes. There's no bomb attached to him. He explodes a scanner style. And the Mayflowers know this is happening beforehand and duck. The auction room is in chaos. The pillar that's been dislodged by the explosion almost falls on Anna. Hudson saves her, but then he gets knocked out by a statue, which, yeah, again, it's just random chaos. And he then wakes up in an ambulance, again, boom, out of nowhere, driven by the Mario brothers, who are overacting madly. Nothing like they were in the previous two scenes. It's a completely different performance. They're mugging at the camera, going, subtlety ain't one of our strong points. And it's like, yes, it was in the first two scenes. It's not in this one for some reason. And this is the one good action scene in the film where Bruce Willis, well, Hudson Hawk, but Bruce Willis, whatever, kind of stabs one of the brothers with a whole bunch of syringes and jumps out the back, tied to the stretcher, and the stretcher's dangling out the back on the LA on the LA on the highway. It's sort of going back and forth, back and forth from like one lane to another. He passes by like a car, and the person in it is like, "Hey, mister, you gonna die?" And yeah, that's a really fun action scene, and it's the one time that works, and one time the film kind of works in an action level.
I actually quite like that. It was, again, it's absurd because, they're on the flat highway and this gurney he's on is keeping pace with
Yeah.
an ambulance, at speed, and he's like controlling it like you would a car. He's just moving his body or whatever. And but when he stabs that guy with all
Oh,
those
yeah.
syringes, it's like it is kind of body horror-ish in the sense
Yeah.
that, like, all of these needles are in this guy's face, and it's a bunch, and they're hanging off, and it's gonna get his skin. And it's again similar to that, the slicing of the neck in the previous couple of scenes, where it's like, wow, this is kind of dark and body horror gore type thing. That was kind of freaky. That set something off in me. I was like, oh my God,
Because
the idea of being, yeah.
it's not Pink Panther-y at all. It's not like the it's not sort of a fun heist film. It's like, oh, this is like violent Bruce Willis stuff now, you know?
Yeah, but you're right. You're right. It totally works better, that chase sequence, even though I think it's kind of short.
Yeah, a lot of the action in this film is very abbreviated. That's one thing that I
Yeah,
noticed.
which is so uncharacteristic of Bruce Willis action films, right? They tend to be long and like they tend to have a payoff. You feel like satisfaction by the end of like an action scene.
Yeah, it's just that everything, all the action seems abruptly cut short, not just with the editing, but it's almost like it was like they were going, oh, we're running out of time here. We're just going to quickly race
Yeah.
to the end of this so that we can move on to the next scene because we ain't got time. That's what it feels
Yeah,
like.
yeah.
And I think going to the Richard E. Grant book, the way he died was meant to be a big action scene. It's set in like the Soviet Union. And it was meant to be this big action scene based on that you would expect from a lot of other Bruce Willis films, cranked to 11. And what comes across is that that had to be rewritten as a completely separate sequence that was a lot shorter. I'm going to come into it later on because we're going to
Nice.
come on to the sections where I'm referring to the book. But what reads between reading, not even reading between the lines, but comes across is that there were a lot of corners cut short on this.
Yeah.
So we go from the ambulance crashing, and as Bruce Willis is going by, he's like, hey guys, you okay? As the ambulance is in flames, which is funny.
Yeah.
He literally wheels up in the stretcher next to our main characters, our next faction, the CIA, led by George Kaplan, played by James Coburn, who I like James Coburn as an actor. For younger viewers, you may not know who he was. He was very famous in the 60s. He was in The Magnificent Seven. He was in spy films, the Flint films. He was very good in the Sergio Leone film, A Fistful of Dynamite. And he's also gives a great performance in, he was in Monsters, Inc. as well, but he gives a great performance in the Paul Schrader film, Affliction, which, if you've not seen it, I recommend you see it. I kind of feel like he gets the tone as well.
Yeah, agreed. I think he, you know, again, I think he plays like quite an interest, you know, quite a, you know, plan within plan type character. And you know, yeah, kind of evil looking.
He's kind of like a character you would get in something like Archer, where he's describing how in a later scene it's like, oh, I once killed a man in Venice, you know, with my bare
Yeah.
hands. And he's, oh, I miss the Cold War. And he's, yeah, it's that sort of CIA humor character that you would get in
Yeah.
American Dad, which does indicate, again, it's one of these things that, as with the slightly campy slash violent tone of this film, make it a little ahead of its time because the campy slash violent tone just feel like something you get in the 2000s with stuff like Lucky Number Slevin and Smoking Aces and later on Kick-Ass and with the Matthew Vaughn films, but it was completely unheard of in the early 90s.
Yeah, that's true. That's a
And
good
you do
point.
wonder if maybe this film would have done better had it been released 20 years later.
Yeah, maybe. I the one of the issues, so you touched on it there, where like he does this action sequence and then his gurney rolls into the next
Oh,
scene,
yeah.
essentially, right? With the villain, right? So like we are now, by this point, we know that like not to give much thought to the transitions on how you get from one scene to another, right? Whether he falls off and we then
Oh,
land
yeah.
into the apartment,
Yeah.
or he just decides to go to the auction house, even though, you know, there is no real need to go to the auction. Yeah, there's no need to think about this.
No.
I think this film suffers for that because it happens too frequently for there to be
Yeah.
like it's weird transition after weird transition after weird transition, and there's no let up in
Yeah,
that.
absolutely. I mean, because there's a transition coming up here where we get Coburn and his four henchmen, who are all named after chocolate bars. The black one's like Almond Joy. One of them is Snickers. There's a mute one played by CSI's David Caruso called Kit Kat. And there's this running gag I don't get where he, this one I didn't get, where he holds up different cards with messages and gives them to
Yeah.
characters. I'm like, yeah, that's one running gag I didn't get at all.
Yeah. There's these four, like, again, are giving us like real character acting energy. Like they're all
Yeah.
doing a bit.
Because there's also like a big fat, there's a big fat clumsy one as well called Butterfinger, who's very stupid, and the joke is that ha ha ha, he's big and he's stupid, which is a dumb running gag.
Yeah, to be honest, I think these four characters add nothing to the story
No.
necessarily, except from being henchmen. But it really like slows the film down to have these four like doing their bits, and it's
Oh,
purely
yeah.
slapstick. There's no narrative use for them, and they get a lot of screen time.
Yeah, they
They're in
do.
the they're in the, yeah they're in the auction house as well. It cuts to all of them in that auction house.
Yeah, and there's also a bit later on where they interrupt a romantic scene between Bruce Willis and Andy McDowell for a god-awful joke, which I'm going to get onto because it is just, even by the tonal shifts of it film. Of the film, it stops it dead.
Yeah.
So Almond Joy shoots a dart into Bruce Willis and he falls into a crate. And when he wakes up from the crate, he's in Rome. Yeah, they
Oh,
managed
yeah.
to, yeah, he, yeah, they kept him sedated all the way from the auction house in America to Rome.
Again, just a mad transition.
Mad transition, and then we see the butler who drives him in this limo with Richard E. Grant, who there's a bit where he's got a fax machine in the limo and he's putting p bits of paper into the fax machine, and the bits of paper are just streaming out into the street for no reason other
Oh
than
God.
random.
I'm remembering bits because you're talking about it. There's so much of this film I've forgotten, and I watched it yesterday. That it's crazy. Like that whole bit, and also like the fact that like w it feels like it's not even that long, but you feel like you haven't seen that butler in a while, and it's probably
Yeah.
like 3 or 4 minutes from that scene or whatever it is. It's that's wild. That car is. I actually love the physical comedy in the car. I think it's quite funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because the only problem with the physical comedy is it's where the main plot's being given to you, like what the Mayflowers want Hudson Hawk to do. So it's kind of very distracting. Because basically, Darwin Mayflower says, but he hired the Marier Brothers and George Kaplan to find Hudson Hawk, and he's driven up to the main headquarters, where we've got, Minerva being obnoxious to start with, but both her and Darwin want Hudson Hawk to get their hand want to get their hands on Da Vinci's gold machine that we saw at the beginning to take over the world. Now, this isn't explained in full till later on in the film, but to be honest, at this point, it's very clear what they want. But for some reason, we're like a bajillion steps ahead of Hudson Hawk here. There's some, the, I mean, they basically want him to, what they do is that they want him to rob Da Vinci's code sketchbook called the Codex from the Vatican. And we get again really sort of tonal shifts here where Hudson Hawk gets his balls chewed on by the dog, which I didn't find funny. It's like, okay, ha ha ha, he gets bitten the crotch. And then which comes back later on in the film. According to Richard E. Grant, apparently the dog was from a local Italian trainer who didn't actually train the dog. So they had to try and get it to They had to spend ages trying to get it to like catch a tennis ball, which is a recurring thing throughout the film, and to try and get it to chew in Bruce Willis's balls, but the dog wouldn't do anything. And they wasted a whole day trying to get the dog to do something.
Yeah, what? Cut it. Do you know what I mean? It really adds nothing to the scene, except from that, that bit, right? It's again, it's just a testament to this film's like commitment to like being absurdist and trying to be slapstick comedy. But they spend a whole day on this one thing.
But we go from this then to before we get to the Codex bit, we get Darwin and Minerva showing the slides of them in S&M gear by accident, with Alfred being involved in it. And again, this why is this R-rated? It's going from childish humor to something very R-rated, and it never, again, who is this film aimed at? What audience are we aiming this at? Kids, adults?
The it doesn't work. It doesn't work for me. Like the type, we compare this to like what you said, Smoking Aces, the Kick-Ass films. But those films still have narrative structure, and they still I don't think this is a successful would be a successful film in the 2020s or the 2010s. Because it's tonally not clicking.
Because films nowadays, you realize how focus grouped they are. You would not get that kind of inconsistency with tones in terms of these two jokes standing side by side with each other in, say, a modern day equivalent, like, say, one of the Netflix films, with Ryan Reynolds.
And if you did get this joke, then the tone of that would be consistent throughout the film, right? Like this, this it never settles. The tone never settles, and you never feel like you are feeling the characters or feeling the narrative. It never settles down to give you a second
And
to enjoy.
even with the heist stuff, the heist film stuff, the tone there is still awkward because we go from like in the next scene, Hudson Hawk's at the Vatican, and this time round he actually stakes out the Codex, which he didn't do beforehand with the statue. He actually sort of uses a toy elephant to set off this complicated security system where a bunch of cages fall into the Codex, which he didn't do before. And but then when he's And then he meets up with Anna, who was giving a guided tour of the Codex, and escapes with her when he sets off the Codex. And they have banter. They escape in like this sort of miniature railway thing that they have, and they banter. He asks Anna on a date, but Anna's then revealed to work again for the Vatican. And this little Jesus statue lights up that's in the Vatican, and it like sends her a secret voice message saying that where she says that Hudson Hawk is telling this cardinal is speaking the other line of, that Hudson Hawk plans to steal the Codex. And it's like, but again, you're going from an Ocean's 11 thing with him trying to work out how to steal the Codex to this Austin Powers slash the James Bond spy thing where she's talking to the cardinal through this like light up Jesus thing. And it's like, okay, what kind of light-hearted tone are we trying to go for here,
Exactly. And again, we have to get like Anna is just in Rome, right? Like as an audience, we just have to constantly like give up to like the lack of logic, right? Like
Oh, yeah,
it's
completely.
never, it's never, and that's fine, right? There's films I love where you can just give into it and you just go, well, I'm not going to look for logic. I'm not going to look for this. But for some reason, this film just makes me, I probably because of the pace of it, it's just like I'm constantly like in a state of like what other new thing are they going to introduce, a new faction, a new point of interest for Hudson Hawk's character. That this was and like you say, the actual again the set work is quite nice. Like they have this big prop that goes over the Codex, and it reminds me of like you say, Austin Powers type over dramatic, set work or what have you. And that's really cool and really enjoyable. But again, we only get really like a second of that, really the good stuff, and
Yeah.
then it's gone.
Yeah, because I mean, we get it again with the heist scene where he
Right.
steals the codex. Where again, now again, this is very different from the heist scene where he stole the horse statue. We see him using all this complicated equipment. He uses the spray that exposes the lasers surrounding the codex. He does all this stuff with mirrors and like liquid to rig up a platform to hoist the codex up out of its pedestal. It's very different from, it's all quiet. There's no music at all. He's not timing himself to the music at all. We've completely abandoned that. So that clearly was a victim, clearly a victim of the reshoots, I'm guessing.
Probably. And also, the thing I love about heist film is like the mythology of like the criminal, right? Like
Yeah.
Ocean's 11, they are building to this heist, and each one has a part to play.
Yeah.
And Inside Man, they've got a plan, and he's enacting the plan. And this is, the opposite. This is like minimal thing, huge payoff, and then over really quickly. So there's none of that satisfaction, I guess, from
No.
watching a heist film in that way.
Yeah, it's literally just Bruce Willis does a thing. Watch him do a thing. It's literally just 5 minutes of watching Bruce Willis do a thing to get the thing that he needs. And then we cut
And
to him, and then we cut to him briefly escaping across the roof with some slapstick humor where he swings on an aerial, a TV aerial, and we see that it interrupts the Pope's TV reception, and the Pope bangs on the TV with his mitre. Ha ha ha. Not really very funny.
dumb. No.
Really? That's the one joke that worked for you, is it?
It's listening to you repeat it that's making me laugh, because it's
And
so dumb and it's
it
so stupid.
is.
Have
And it's,
It's
but
listening to you repeat it that's making me laugh.
it's so fucking perfunctory though, because it's literally just a bit of rooftop chase work. He then jumps down onto like a van filled with chickens, and this is the one transition that does work. The van filled with chickens pulls up outside the restaurant he's supposed to meet Anna with, and he jumps from the van to the seat opposite Anna, and he spits out chicken feathers in front of her. That's the one bit that works. But again, what I've just described is a very short action sequence. You know, the escape is not fun. The action sequences like that are only fun if you don't abbreviate them. You know, you need to give them a good 4 or 5 minutes or so. Come on, you know?
I mean, you are a much like bigger student of film than I am, but like the use of like tension and spectacle in action is like, it's such a useful device to get us to feel something and get us to go on that
Oh,
journey.
God, yeah, so
And
much so.
the lack of it is just, it's so unsatisfying. I was really struggling by this point to care and also pay attention, right? There's so much money on screen, and yet my attention was just evaporating.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, God, I mean, I'm not to go off on too much of a tangent, but there's a Hong Kong, a John Woo film that came out around the same year as this called Once a Thief. It's about a heist that takes place in France. Very similar subject matter to Hudson Hawk. So much better with the heist sequences, which combine comedy, tension. They are so much more better constructed. And John Woo was working on a tenth of Hudson Hawk's budget. And it really goes to show how lazy Hollywood can be compared with other countries. But yeah, so anyway, the restaurant scene. After the restaurant scene, we go back to the apartment, Hudson's apartment, where we finally get the origin for his nickname, which is weird. You know, you'd think Hudson Hawk is, yeah, you'd think Hudson Hawk comes in because he flies in and out of situations like a hawk. He does a lot of jumping off roofs, so on and so forth. But no, it's because he's named after, because he grew up next to the Hudson River, which and which I and but and in the winter, the Hudson winter wind is cold, and it's called a hawk. So therefore, he's Hudson Hawk.
What a
What?
dumb way. What a dumb way to have a nickname. Like, how many thousands of people live next to the Hudson? How little does it relate to him as a character for him to be called that?
I don't know. It's like sort of, oh fuck, I don't know what, I don't know what an example of an equivalent would be. It's like, I don't know, the shadow being called the shadow because he's so introverted that he's like a shadow. That's the only example I'm coming up at the top of my head. It's like, why make it so convoluted?
And it's really like weird how he explains it, and it's actually quite a nice name that rolls off the tongue, and you think that this wouldn't be a problem in the film. Like a bit of backstory
Oh,
on how he got his name. But yeah, it's a complete like
so
it's
dumb,
really awkward and
so
wordy.
dumb, so dumb. But yeah, anyway, we get more of the Willis McDowell chemistry, which at least works. And they're about to go in for a kiss, but then Anna discovers that Hudson stole the codex, and we discover the CIA are waiting outside, and that. And then we cut to the CIA waiting outside, and we get the big guy Butterfinger, because they say, "Oh, what's taking them so long?" And the big guy Butterfinger goes, "Want me to rape him?"
Oh yeah, I hated that so much. I mean, obviously, like it's such a bad line. It's such a it comes out of nowhere. And again, it just proves that these four characters that they put in have no use in this story.
But
And could have been cut.
once again, light-hearted, bouncy heist film, rape joke.
Exactly. It's so tonally off. And really took me by surprise. I couldn't believe it, like
Also, the
when it just came
character,
out of nowhere.
that henchman character, is also played as a comedy dumb guy. It's like, I'm so dumb. So when he makes a joke like that, it's just it. And he says it in quite a deadpan way as well. It's like, excuse me, what?
This is like the difference between like we were talking at the start about the sort of fat jokes between the Bruce Willis's character and his friend Danny Aiello being wrapped up in banter of the time, but probably maybe in forgivable and maybe like cheeky and friendship banter. This, on the other hand, is its use is kind of a bit disgusting.
It's nasty.
It's nasty. Exactly, it comes from a character who is villainous and I didn't like this at all, this bit.
So we also get back to the apartment, not a jarring transition at all. We totally needed that little outside bit. Anna reveals that she's been tracking the Mayflowers and says that they've been obsessed with stealing pieces of Da Vinci's artwork. First it was the horse statue, now then it was the Codex. She then offers Hudson a cappuccino, only for him to realize it's been drugged, and he collapses, only for Anna to be, for the CIA to burst in, and it for it to be revealed that Anna's been working with them as well. So another big reveal.
The vascular leagues of the CIA who is just
It's hard to keep
and
track of.
it's super hard to keep track of, and again it only gets worse. Like we're getting into the middle here, but it's only going to get worse and
I mean it's
more
50 odd, I
convoluted.
mean 50 odd minutes into like a film that's just only like slightly over an hour and a half long, you know.
It's again we talked about the running jokes coming through, and now we really get into the point where like everyone is tied to each other in some way, and it's not in the sort of charming thriller way or mysterious thriller way, I should say, where it's like they all have motives for betraying each other or
Yeah.
whatever. It's all they all just have connections for some reason.
Yeah, and it's all just so hard to keep track of. But now we cut to an Italian castle, which is the base of the Mayflower's operations. They have two lairs. We have one in Rome and one in this castle, which seems to have been a last-minute script change, according to Richard E. Grant, because there was meant to be this whole bit set in what was then the Soviet Union. which is why they filmed stuff in Hungary. But they then decided to move it to this castle in Italy for some reason.
Okay.
But they kept filming the interiors in Hungary. So all the inside shots of this castle are in studio in Hungary, yet all the exterior shots of the castle are in Italy, because they
Oh,
originally were
gosh.
going to go for Hungary, because the guy, the producer, owned the studio and they wanted to film scenes set in the Soviet Union. When the script was changed to have the rest of the finale set in Italy, they still couldn't get out of the Hungary stuff because it was cheaper to film there, because again, the producer owned the studio. So they had to film the interior shots of the castle in Hungary. Does that all make sense?
Wild, wild. That's crazy to me.
It gets even worse, because when I go on to the finale, because they reshot all that, Richard E. Grant says it better than me, so I'll just quote him. But anyway, at this Italian castle, Anna confronts George Kaplan about working with the Mayflowers. Kaplan's then revealed to be double-crossing Anna, who was then revealed to be an actual nun working for the Vatican, because she then leaves the castle and goes to the Vatican. And the cardinal then reveals that if the Mayflowers get all three crystal pieces, they'll power the gold machine that they're working on rebuilding in the castle. That's which is why they want the Codex to get the plans for, and they would ruin the world economy. So that's their big plan revealed by a side character. And then we get do you want to step in, or do you want me to carry on with the plot?
Yo, carry on, carry on.
Okay.
I'm enjoying the breakdown.
Hudson is then brought. We then go back from the Vatican bubble to the castle. Nice Vatican castle, where Hudson Hawk is brought before the Mayflowers at the castle. The Codex is ripped open to reveal another crystal piece, as well as the plans for how to build the gold machine. Hudson then takes another mysterious package whilst the Mayflowers aren't looking, foreshadowing, and he knocks up the guards in kind of a funny way. He sort of elbows them, and yeah, it's funny the way he does it. He says, "Oh, you mean knock them out like this?" and sort of moves his arms to demonstrate I was knocking them out. I'm not doing it very well audially, but it's something that works well visually. My mind is a little. This film broke my mind a little bit, I just want to say. But Alfred then stops him in his track with his little wrist sword thing, and Hudson gets knocked out yet again. And the Mayflowers then basically reveal what the Cardinal said. So, really tight script writing here about their plans to use the gold machine, get the gold, yada, yada, yada. They also want Hudson Hawk to steal Da Vinci plants to steal Da Vinci's flying machine from some museum in France. I think it's the Louvre. And Hudson Hawk refuses. The Mayflower. Oh, actually, by the way, I want to say, when the Mayflowers talk to Hudson Hawk after he's been knocked out, it's actually back in their apartment, back in their Rome headquarters. The film jumps around a lot. The Mayflowers then sort of leave the room, and we find out that dun dun dun, Danny Aiello is back in the film after so long. Finally, Big D is back, and he is now working with the Mayflowers because they offered a lot of money to him. Do you want to step in here, Joel, or do you want me to talk about the fight scene that comes after?
I'll step in and just say that this is very like this. You did very well, by the way, just
Oh,
explaining that,
God.
because I was concerned for you for this podcast, because I was like, there's no way he's going to be able to talk through each plot point side by side, because it makes no sense. And there's so many moments where they go back to the Mayflowers, or Kaplan, the CIA guy, gets involved, or to no difference, right? There's no stakes, because they're constantly just letting Hudson Hawk continue doing his thing, and he's ultimately just letting them do their thing. So this part of the film is where it really is hard to care. It's so hard to care, and it's so hard to keep track of,
Oh,
because
God.
nothing happens and lots happen at the same time.
Yeah, again, you can tell this is being rewritten on the fly, because all these plot points being thrown at you at a very quick pace. And you're just like, wait, what? I mean, it's like what you said in the beginning. It is a fever dream. Events happen, characters pop out of nowhere. You're just as confused as Bruce Willis is, which, to be fair, they at least have him being confused. And you can see why a general audience just couldn't keep up with this. You go from the linear simplicity of Die Hard and So Help Me, with Look Who's Talking films, which, talking babies, not that hard to work out, to something like this. If I was an audience, if I was a regular Joe audience member walking in to see a Bruce Willis film and I got all this, I my head would explode, like the
I
auctioneer.
also yeah, no, the auctioneer, exactly. I think also from a technical point of view, there's a lot of like them having to go to Hungary and Rome, and they're obviously shooting on location a lot, and they're obviously shooting in
Yes.
different studios and stuff. And I think it really is a to the detriment of the film, because it visually, from a like cinematographer's point of view, it's not consistent either, right? Like it's not hasn't got a consistent visual
No.
style, like let's say Pink Panther, right? Comedy, but it kind of looks the same, it's kind of lit the same, it's kind
Yes.
of emphasized in the same way. It's got a little, it has like nods to a little bit in like noir. And stuff. Whereas this is very flat. It's very like
Yeah.
lit in a flat way, just so you can see the action, so you can see the things. And
Yeah.
then in the heist, you actually get quite nice dramatic
Yeah.
lighting in
Moody,
certain
dark
points.
lighting, and you get
Right.
the Da Vinci stuff in the beginning is really well lit. And if you compare it with how the Gold Machine is lit in the beginning to how it's lit in the climax, completely
Oh, completely
different.
different.
Because
And then also,
the film also
oh,
had
sorry, Gavin.
two cinematographers, according to Richard E. Grant. Apparently, the first one, he was German, got fired and was replaced by another cinematographer.
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all. Like it totally doesn't look the same. I there's sometimes you get the goofy sound effects of action,
Oh, yeah.
and then sometimes you don't. It's again, it's just inconsistent, and it makes me just really not like disengage with it.
So anyway, Tommy explains his betrayal to Hudson. Hudson is like, "What the fuck, dude?" And they start fighting. They burst out onto the balcony. They fall down onto some stairways. Hudson shoots Tommy, and he's like, "Oh no, Tommy." He then gets loaded onto an ambulance. The villains are watching this and they're going, "Ah ha ha." But Hudson's had to turn in his best friend. And then the ambulance is then loaded onto a Vatican van, like a spy film, like something out of a Bond film. I guess it's the secret Vatican, or the damned secret Vatican organization, to quote George Kaplan. Why the Vatican is a spy organization filled with a secret agent nuns, film doesn't explain. But we then find out that the whole thing was set up by Hudson and Tommy. Apparently, Hudson knew Tommy was in on it. Like, sorry, what? When we, because that's the thing. There's, I mean, we cut briefly from them briefly confronting each other to them fighting outside. So presumably Hudson was told about Tommy not really betraying him then, and them agreeing to the setup. But then, how did they get the fake blood in time? What? How? Why? My head. And
Yeah, I think like,
also Anna is in on it as well. But how could she be in on
yeah,
it?
yeah, exactly. And it's obvious, you know what I mean? Just because
Oh yeah.
it's so clearly like they're not good there, you know, like that they're going to, this is going to be a fake out. And that, you know, but just because we know the film is, you know, trying to be unpredictable in its narrative or whatever, you just know that this is just not, you know, not real. They're falling out of a window. It gets shot, he's like, ah, and then they go to the ambulance, which they just let drive off, even though Hudson Hawk is alive and in there. That's pretty wild. And you know, comparatively, you know, in the first Ocean film, we're talking like more of a serious heist film.
Oh.
There's that fake out where Brad Pitt's character kicks Danny Ocean out of the crew
Yeah.
because he's jeopardized it. And it's a fake out, right? And that he's actually down in the vault, and it's all part of the plan. And it's a nice little payoff. You know, they've kind of just done it to prank Matt Damon a little bit, which is just it's absurd, but it's like we kind of buy into it because of their cheekiness and their like their abilities as cat burglars,
But it's
whatever.
all, but it's
This.
all, yeah. Sorry, but what were you going to say? Sorry.
No, I was just going to say this is the opposite. There's the payoff
Oh.
is worthless and is easy to predict and sloppily done.
Yeah, and it just seems to be, but it's not laid out as well. It's just thrown in there because we need a twist. It's not
Yeah.
carefully laid out at all. Yeah, it's just, oh God. So, anyways, back at the apartment, Hudson Hawk is woken up by the CIA and Kaplan. They get two of their agents to paralyze. He gets two of his agents to paralyze Hudson Hawk and Tommy. And there's this unfunny bit where they're all contorted and kind of paralyzed, like they're pulling silly faces, but they're able to talk as well. They can't move, yet they can sort of move sometimes. And Andy McDowell also gets shot with a dart, but then it makes her speak gibberish, but it doesn't make Bruce Willis and Danny Aiello talk gibberish, and nothing makes sense anymore. Hudson is then framed for stealing the helicopter thing, which the CIA already did. They've got their hands in the third crystal. Yeah, and the CIA kidnap Anna, take her back to the castle. They plant a bomb in the kitchen using this bomb grenade launcher machine thing that fires like a sticky bomb that sticks onto things. Hudson Hawk then paralyzes the Almond Joy agent and then fires a bomb into Snickers's head. I don't know why I'm keeping track of their names, I just do. And then
Yeah,
Hudson
fair
and
enough.
Tommy jump out of the apartment as the bomb explodes. Right. Do you want to jump in, or do you want me to carry on with the plot?
I think I'll just add to this is although it's been sloppy all the way through, I would argue this is a real mark, I think, at this stage of the film where things are descending very quickly. Towards an ending, right? It's just like let's snowball down to this ending that's coming, it just we're gonna get to it, but like they can't fit the pieces together for some reason. It's just this very weird thing where they can't fit three pieces of a puzzle
Oh,
together,
yeah.
and it's just weird. It's just like unnecessary, and just so that they need Hudson Hawk or they need Anna. Which makes no, it just makes no sense.
Yeah, well, basically, they're at the castle and they're trying to fit pieces, the Da Vinci gold machine crystal pieces together, because they've got to fit together in a certain machine. It forgot to fit together in a certain way to put into the machine to power it to make the gold. They're trying to ask Anna about it because they can't figure it out themselves, even though surely the book would explain it. Why they don't just consult the book, I have no idea, but they're waggling the pieces in front of their face like a child, and they're trying to talk to her, but the drug that they've given her is making her witter on about dolphins and do dolphin squeaks. And poor Andy McDowell, she's good at a lot of things. She can't pull off that kind of comedy. There's another film that she did, which I'm going to cover in a later episode, called Town and Country, where she has to do similar comedy, and she's not good at that either.
Yeah, I think like where she brings the good stuff between like the chemistry with Bruce Willis and the more, low key subtle acting, what if you could say that even existed in the film, I think she thrives in. Even given very little, but these slapstick comedy, I don't think is in her wheelhouse, and I think
No.
it makes it look a bit awkward. And it's fair enough. It's quite a difficult thing to pull off.
Yeah, I mean, she's very good at rom-com stuff. She was in Four
Yeah,
Weddings and a Funeral and the film
of course.
Green Card. But yeah, it's I don't envy her here because it's tough for her to pull off. We then get this weird bit where Hudson and Tommy break into the castle, where it starts off, they're doing this in the day, then they're hanging off the roof, then they're getting to the castle wall, and it's like it's sunset by the time they break into the castle and knock out the guards. And apparently, according to the director, that's supposed to be intentionally funny, but I don't think it is. It just looks like a continuity error.
Just going to say that the singing that
Oh, yeah.
they start naming songs again and singing, and it's just like we get these really lazy cuts between Andy, what's her name from what's her name
Andy,
from Sports?
Andy McDowell.
Yes. Where she's getting like interrogated, because these guys like jauntily rocking up to the castle, firing rockets around, and like having just a great time doing it. So it's just like, where's the tension? Where am I
Yeah.
supposed to care? This felt sloppy and like not very much fun.
Oh yeah, because they're basically doing the whole singing at the auction house thing, only this time they're assaulting a castle, and they're just
Yeah.
moseying, but they're moseying along, singing away as they're blowing up things with blowing up bits of the castle with rocket launchers, not really aiming anywhere in particular, I notice. And whilst that's going on, the CIA agents are getting killed by the Mayflowers. And in quite brutal ways. And Anna has to beat up Minerva to escape. And yeah, the tonal, it just doesn't, it's very, it's because it's not even comedy, action comedy done in a fun way. It's like they're just walking around, they're just sort of moseying along, firing rockets in a very slow-paced way.
It doesn't really add anything, and it slows everything down. And by this point, my brain was just melting. And I had to do this in two parts, this film.
Oh.
And I was just, my brain was melting, I have to
What
say.
about the comedy kung fu fight we then get between Hudson Hawk and George Kaplan, where
Oh my God.
it's shot like it, to be fair, it is the closest you would get in an early 90s film to like a Jackie Chan comedy kung fu scene, because it's like undercranked, sped up with the James Coburn's double throwing lots of kung fu kicks, and he kicks Bruce Willis and he goes back and forth like a sort of punching bag. I kind of liked that, I thought, and it kind of, I don't know how they did it, but it was very funny because his feet are rooted to the ground, but he's rocking back and forwards and fast paced. But again, it's different kind of humor from what we got beforehand, and it's completely different to the violence we got beforehand. It's tonally suited to like what the film should be, but it's the only sequence that's slapstick like this.
And by this point, I didn't really care about the CIA guy. How like towards the end of the film where
Yeah.
your hero meets a villain, and they fight and scrap, and then you get the satisfaction from them overcoming the enemy, right? Like every action film has it to a degree. It's a trope of the genre. It's there to give us some cathartic ending. They gave us that, and this is what they're doing. They're fighting at the end of the film. And if Hudson Hawk had died instead of that guy, I probably would have not blinked twice.
Yeah.
I'd be like, oh, well, that's okay. Bye, Hudson Hawk.
Because everything is played for laughs, and it just, and also the plot's so convoluted by this point, you're like, oh, it's this guy again? Really? He's still in this film?
For some reason, the head of this CIA operation is just moseying around this castle and just stumbled over Hudson Hawk.
Yeah. And now I'm going to go to the Richard E. Grant book now, finally, to describe what was originally meant to be shot. Now, he says, my death scene in the original version involved a fight between Bruce and me in the back of a purple limousine, fighting, ending up in us having fisticuffs through the sunroof. This would then reveal that the car is going down the interior corridors of the Kremlin in the Soviet Union, before it crashes into a large statue of Lenin, which topples forward and chops my head off, which is why the last part of the film is going to be shot in Budapest, because that would stand in for Moscow, but cheaper and closer. For a variety of reasons, all this has been chucked out, and the finale has been rewritten to take place in Italy. We still have to go to Budapest to shoot the Italian interiors of the castle in a Hungarian studio owned by a producer living in Los Angeles. And that's the madness of Hollywood. What then happened? But they didn't want to lose the limousine fight, so instead, we get it happening on location here in Italy. but it's now the fight scenes between Danny Aiello and Richard E. Grant. So Tommy Fivetone is kidnapped by Alfred, dragged into the limousine, where for some reason he fights Darwin, who he's not met at all and has no real connection with, and they are fist they have this fist fight in the they have this fist fight in the limousine, which ends with Darwin initially getting sort of almost knocked out, but oh, and we get a reason for Tommy Fivetone's nickname. At this point in the film, at this time only, whenever he punches Richard E. Grant, every time he punches him, you hear a different tone, like a tone being played on a piano. That's a really dumb way to get his nickname, and I only found it out once I listened again closely.
And it's not called out, considering this film has 1,000 callback references to previous jokes. That could have been set up in a countless number of ways.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even clock that, and it didn't come to me at all.
Totally. So both Darwin and Alfred jump out of the limousine and it falls off a cliff with Tommy inside and it explodes. So
Does it
that's.
not have Chaplin on it as well, or no?
Does it not what?
Have Chaplin, the CIA guy, on the hood of the car.
He's in it. He goes off
Sorry,
as well. He goes off. Him and the limo and Tommy Fivetone go off and it explodes. And then Anna also catches up with Hudson outside and he's like, Anna, what happened? And she's like, oh, I escaped. And again, tonally, that's a bit of comedy that comes before Danny Aiello dying. And then immediately afterwards, he finds out Danny Aiello's died. And again, tonal shifts all over the place. He then goes to attack Richard E. Grant, goes to beat him up, but the butler then whacks him out.
Oh my gosh. I can't believe it's we're still going. I can't believe it. It's impressive.
I mean, we're on the home straight. It's we're on the home straight here. We're coming on to the finale now, which is the reshot scene in Hungary. I guess the opening scene, it must have been shot in the same place as the opening, because they wouldn't have shot it in different studios. So, but it looks so cheap. We cut to like the interior of the castle where the gold machine is being built, and the Mayflowers have Hudson and Anna there because they want to know how the gold pieces fit together, and they're going on about how they ran to Richard E. Grant, a poor Richard E. Grant. He's rambling on about eating sushi naked off a woman or something, and going on about like the European Union or something. I don't know, but him and Sandra Bernhard are saying all this mad shit that basically ends in we want to use the gold machine to take over, but become really rich and be take over the world.
Again, it's just there's no basis, or we don't there's no stakes at this point. It's moot what they want, right? Like, it doesn't matter. Like, they could want the gold to build themselves a new limousine, and it would make as much sense.
Yeah, so they're building. So anyway, they need Hudson and Anna to Hudson to work out how the three pieces to go together. Anna shows them, and it's like, and then as they're putting it into the machine, she goes, "Hey, Hudson, if I put the three pieces together in the wrong order, it would be really bad, right?" And Hudson goes, "Yeah. And if I was missing an extra piece," and he pulls out another piece, the piece that he took earlier that we didn't see. Clearly, he reveals there was a fourth piece that was meant to go into the machine, which is a bit of a fake out twist, a cheap twist. That would be real bad. And they go, oh yeah, real. And it goes, oh yeah, real bad. And so when the gold to the when the crystal machine is put into the gold machine, it explodes. And Richard E. Grant gets electrocuted, which had to be shot. Which is literally the last thing the guy shot before he got out of Hungary. And it looks like it was filmed in a hurry, literally got Richard E. Grant writhing on the ground, going, Rrr. And Sandra Bernhardt's covered in gold and screaming, but no indication she's dead. But then Hudson then says, oh, Darwin and Minerva are dead. And then And then they leave, then they quickly run out, only to be discovered by Alfred, who says how. For some reason, he's got his hand up like a Native American, saying how. And I don't know why he's doing that.
The film is
Do you want to come in here, Joel, just to relieve me a bit?
mental. I think I should. I think this is like we're just going from like trope to trope, right? The fight between the hero and the villain, maybe like the car scene, and then like the machine not working and blowing up, and because a piece is missing. And you touched on it before about how much poorer this looks than our opening when we're
Yeah.
with Da Vinci in
Very
Thing.
flat lighting.
Very flat lighting. Richard E. Grant is like humping the air
Oh,
while the machine
God.
is going off. There's all these bits and right, like there's no like so if we think about like Pirates of the Caribbean as an action film, when they have that fight scene in the blacksmith's when Orlando Bloom's character and Johnny Depp's character first meet or whatever, not first meet, but they fight in the blacksmith place. They use the whole room, right? Like
Yeah.
they over by the fire, they do that, then they end up on the roof, and then they end up on the wheel. And this, they have this huge, beautiful set, and they're all standing in separate spaces, all going through different things. And none of them get to explore the space in a way that's like, it's so meaningless having the set. That's the beauty of having a set, having a space for your actors to inhabit and enjoy and to, let them get immersed in. But they are all basically standing statically in different parts of the set. It's wild how little it's used.
I just want to come in. I know why Alfred says how at the beginning.
Okay.
It's because right after, right, apparently the ending originally was supposed to have Alfred confronting Hudson Hawk dressed as a Native American. He was
Oh,
going to
God.
reveal that he was going to use the gold, the melted gold, to re-establish the British Empire and take back
Oh,
America.
my God. Thank God that this plot line didn't get pushed through. But it still doesn't understand why he says how, really, ultimately. That doesn't really still make sense, even though, oh my God. I imagine there must be stuff on the cutting room floor with this film.
Oh, God.
Because I imagine they had to get it to 1 hour 30. So like we can't market it. We at least
Yeah.
have to make this to 1 hour 30. So I can't imagine what horrible stuff they left on
Oh,
the cutting room floor.
don't even go there. But what does break out, however, is a good fight between. I actually like this fight sequence between Alfred and Hudson Hawk, where he's got like the twin blades coming out of his arms. Again, this just feel a little ahead of its time. This feels before the 2000s, where you have a resurgence in martial arts in cinema, where you got more of his fight scenes, and you've got him fighting with Bruce Willis, and Anna's trying to help him by firing the gun, but she keeps on like hitting Bruce Willis, and it's bouncing the bullets of Bruce Willis's metal belt or whatever, and he's like, "Stop helping me!" But then the way it ends is, and I realized, oh, actually, no, I'll describe this bit first and then I'll go back. The fight then ends with the guy getting his head chopped off with both his like knives, which again, very violent for a light-hearted caper movie. And then Bruce gives this one-liner about not being able to attend a hat convention, which doesn't work. It's like, could you not say, don't lose your head, you know?
Yeah, there's probably 1,000 lines you could add there that would make more sense than that line.
Yeah, there's also a bit earlier on where he confronts the Butterfinger character in like Venice. He's in a phone booth and he's trying to talk to Tommy, and he like Butterfinger wants to talk to him about something, and he grabs the character and smashes his head into the like phone booth, and it's really bloody. You see blood come out of his nose and everything, and that's so graphically violent compared we get what we get to the rest of the film.
Yeah,
It's
definitely.
just, I mean, again, repeating ourselves, tonally inconsistent violence, blah, blah, blah. We then get a bit where the dog, Bunny, tries to attack Andy McDowell, and it's like something out of Monty Python, like where the rabbit attacks the knights, where it's like clearly this fake dog attacking Andy McDowell, and Hudson Hawk uses the Mayflower's tennis machine to shoot it out the window. And it's totally different from the decapitation, the violent decapitation we got earlier on.
Yeah.
Tonally inconsistent. I'm just gonna maybe race a little bit through this so that you can add stuff, because otherwise
Yeah.
I'm gonna lose my voice and the will to live. So Hudson and Anna then escape through Da Vinci's flying machine, which actually does work, and it's a nice bookend with the beginning of the film, which held so much promise. The flying sequence is really good, and they well filmed, and they land on the ground in an Italian village. Hudson goes, "Boy, this it really sucks that Tommy isn't here." And look who turns up, but Tommy. And originally, when Danny Aiello showed up, his hair, because he was supposed to die, but Danny decided he wanted to live, because anything can happen in the movies. So he wrote lines, which Tommy later says, where he had a hidden, there was a hidden ejector seat in the Mayflower's limo that he uses to eject himself out. And that's how he would escape. But then they wanted to have him turn up because he'd been horribly burnt. He would need to have at least ash on his face and his hair all messed up. Danny Aiello, when it came to filming the scene where he meets up with Hudson and Andy McDowell, threw a massive hissy fit. He says, "Nobody touches my goddamn hair." So they couldn't mess up his hair or put makeup on him to show he'd been really burnt. So instead, they had to have him come out as he normally did, and they had to write in, not only does he say when Andy McDowell says, "Why aren't you horribly burnt, Tommy?" instead of just having the ejector seat line, they had to have in a line say that says, "Because he's not horribly burnt, there was a sprinkler system set in the back of the limo. That's why I look totally fine."
Yeah, I remember this. It's wild. It's like I quite like, you're right, you said it's a nice bookend, and they wonder, it's funny them just wandering through this Italian village chatting away, and he's got this huge scar across his chest, and he's, they're all a mess, and then Tommy just pops up. Hey Tommy, hey, great to see you again. It's so like weird and surreal, and
And it's
it kind of fits. Just like it's as good an ending as you could probably have for a film like
and at
this.
least the and at least the characters are kind of treating it as weird, because Bruce says, "Yeah, that's probably what happened. Time for a t time for a time for a cappuccino, finally," and then just chucks it over his shoulder.
Oh God, yeah, like it's so he actually gets his cappuccino at the end, and I was like, oh, thank God this is done. Thank God this is finished.
So
Put down on this movie.
that's the end of Hudson Hawk. I'm gonna let you talk, Joel, about what you feel about this film and what are your thoughts just in general. You kind of play us out here.
Yeah, this is for me. This is quite simple. It's not a good film. It's in the sense that like it's over. It's too complicated. It's too complex, and it's like in it. Machinations of narrative. It's tonally all over the place. It's not that fun. For a
No.
film that is like, if you're gonna market it, be like, hey, go with a bunch of mates and have a laugh. Like I think like these days we have like films that are bad and fun, and we all kind of get behind them and we enjoy them because they're over the top, or like The Room, they're so weird that it's funny. This doesn't have that charm. This doesn't have that innocence. There's so much money spent on this, and there's so many sets and so much resources that it kind of doesn't have that fun effect where you're like, oh, the writing's so goofy, fee or whatever. The whole film just feels broken and chopped to pieces and then put back together. And it feels like Hollywood's excess has greenlit something without really thinking about it. And it's just you can see the problems all over it, basically.
It,
But yeah, that's my take.
I mean, it reminds me a lot of another kind of star vehicle that went badly wrong 2 years later, Last Action Hero, in that it feels excessive. Everything is ramped up to 11. The comedy, the action, not so much, but it's very frenetic and loud. And the indecisiveness rather, is off the scale. It's, we don't know what tone we're going for. Is this action? Is this comedy? Are we going light? Are we going dark? There's really all, there's no hand at the wheel here. So we get all the ideas thrown into one, and there's just, with the hope that something will come out of it. It's all over the place. And if it doesn't work, they do the Hollywood trick of throwing more money at it to see if it solves the problem. And it doesn't. And like Last Action Hero with Arnold Schwarzenegger, it flopped as well. And I mean, you could see why, because also what you get the impression is that in the early 90s, people had a very firm idea of what a Bruce Willis action film would look like and what an Arnold Schwarzenegger film would look like. It would either look like Die Hard or Predator, or it would very much feature your wisecracking hero with the guns. You would not have much humor apart from the one-liners. You would have a fairly steady throughfare in terms of a plot, and it would be a coherent situation. Hudson Hawk does none of that, and neither does Last Action Hero. Hudson Hawk is just all over the place, and I can see why the studio had trouble marketing it, because how would you market this towards your average Bruce Willis fan? You know,
Well, to
to
any demographic, really, it would be tricky, especially in like the 90s.
Because it's too childish for adults, but too adult for child for kids. I mean, it's got too much violence and sexual content in it.
It just doesn't like it doesn't have like the boldness either of like some more modern takes on like comedy action, right? Like it has its foot in and out of these doors a little bit. So yeah, I struggled with this one a lot. Like I just didn't like enjoy watching it. Like I know, but like I would normally do with like a silly fun film. This felt actually hard work.
What do you think though works about like your Matthew Vaughn films that are very like this? I mean, although I know Argylle was getting same criticisms as this, and the stuff like Smoking Aces and all that, what makes Shoot 'Em Up and Kick-Ass, what makes these films work in a way that Hudson Hawk, what makes these films work in a way that Hudson Hawk doesn't?
Well, it's interesting because one, I think the action is taken seriously, right? Like the way the action is done. So let's take Kingsman, for example, or or Kick-Ass. Let's talk about Vaughn, right? Like the action is taken seriously. It's tense. It has motive. It has meaning, and has significance for the plot. Then you introduce this like dark comedic sense, which fits in with the sort of graphic violence, right? Very rarely is it kind of goofy. It's tonally dark, and therefore has an adult audience. And it looks the same and it's lit the same way and it's character focused, right? Like the characters all intertwine with one another. I care about the characters. The characters have something to say and something to do. Where this is none of that, right? The action doesn't make sense. The characters don't make sense. I don't feel emotionally connected to any of the characters or the story. Tonally, visually, it's all off. So it just it's although like the mark of an action comedy, it's so different to other more modern takes. And I'm sure there's like you're so familiar with like Hong Kong cinema,
Oh
where
yeah.
like where visual fights are and comedy are more common, right? So
Yeah.
it's not about being old or newer. It just it fails at its ultimate task, and it doesn't really know what it wants to be.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't even match up to the Hong Kong action comedy one because it doesn't have the choreography. They wouldn't have been aware of it at the time. And number two, that kind of humor just doesn't work as well in the West. It works better in Hong Kong, which is maybe why the film did better internationally. I can see why this film would do well in East Asia, like Japan, Hong Kong, South Korea. That kind of zaniness really plays well over there. I don't know about mainland Europe, but I could say it does for Hong Kong. Surprisingly, didn't do as badly in Britain. It got more of a mixed 50-50 response. But I certainly didn't rate it. Bloody hell. So yeah, I think that's shall we just leave Hudson Hawk to one side, put him back in his cage?
Yeah, I will rest happy knowing I never have to see Hudson Hawk again.
Right. Well, Films That Time. Well, that was our episode on Hudson Hawk. Films That Time Forgot is available on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, and other podcast Apple Music, Amazon Music, and other podcast outlets, which I do not have the energy to name right now. But if you want to get access episodes a week early, you please subscribe to my Patreon at Thorny Film Reviews. That's Thorny, Film Reviews. For £6, you get access to this podcast and my vlog. No, not my vlog. My sort of my blog on written film reviews. Also, I write for the Wii Review. That's WEEReview.com. You can access my written reviews there on films. Also, join me next episode when we look at the twist-filled Alec Baldwin thriller from 1993, Malice. So until then, keep watching.